keeping up the shrines was as close, spiritually, as Constant could get to his son. He respected what his son was trying to do with religion. And sometimes, when Constant gazed at a refurbished shrine, he moved the elements of his own life about experimentally. But he did it in his head. At such times, he was likely to reflect, in melancholy, on two things in particular. His murder of Stony Stevenson, his best and only friend, and his winning, so late in life, the love of Beatrice Rumford. Constant never found out whether Chrono knew who tidied up the shrines. Chrono may have thought his god or gods were doing it. It was all so sad, but it was all so beautiful, too. Beatrice Rumford lived alone in Rumford's Taj Mahal. Her contacts with Chrono were far more harrowing than Constance. At unpredictable intervals, Chrono would swim out to the palace, dress himself from Rumford's wardrobe, announce that it was his mother's birthday, and spend the day in indolent, sullen, reasonably civilized discourse. At the end of such a day, Chrono would rage at the clothes and his mother and civilization. He would tear off the clothes, scream like a bluebird, and dive into the Winston Sea. When Beatrice had suffered through one of these birthday parties, she would thrust an oar into the sand of the beach that faced the nearest shore, and she would fly a white sheet from it. It was a signal for Malachi Constant, begging him please to come at once, to help her calm down. And when Constant arrived in response to the signal of distress, Beatrice always comforted herself with the same words.
"At least," she would say, "he isn't a mama's boy. And at least he had the greatness of soul to join the noblest, most beautiful creatures in sight."
The white sheet, the signal of distress, was flying now. Malachi Constant put out from shore in a dugout canoe. The gilded rowboat that had come with the palace had long since been sunk by dry rot. Constant was wearing an old blue wool bathrobe that had once belonged to Rumford. He had found it in the palace, had taken it when his space wanderer's suit wore out. It was his only garment, and he wore it only when he went calling on Beatrice. Constant had in the dugout canoe with him 6 plover's eggs, 2 quarts of wild Titanic strawberries, a 3-gallon peat crock of fermented daisy milk, a bushel of daisy seeds, 8 books he had borrowed from the 40,000-volume library in the palace, and a homemade broom and a homemade shovel. Constant was self-sufficient. He raised or gathered or made everything he needed. This satisfied him enormously. Beatrice was not dependent on Constant. Rumford had stocked the Taj Mahal lavishly with earthling food and earthling liquor. Beatrice had plenty to eat and drink, and always would have. Constant was bringing native foods to Beatrice because he was so proud of his skills as a woodsman and husbandman. He liked to show off his skills as a provider. It was a compulsion. Constant had his broom and shovel along in the dugout canoe because Beatrice's palace was always a broom and shovel mess. Beatrice did no cleaning, so Constant got rid of the worst of the refuse whenever he paid her a visit. Beatrice Rumford was a springy, one-eyed, gold-toothed, brown old lady, as lean and tough as a chair slat. But the class of the damaged and roughly used old lady showed through. To anyone with a sense of poetry, mortality, and wonder, Malachi Constant's proud, high-cheekboned mate was as handsome as a human being could be. She was probably a little crazy. On a moon with only 2 other people on it, she was writing a book called The True Purpose of Life in the Solar System. It was a refutation of Rumford's notion that the purpose of human life in the solar system was to get a grounded messenger from Tralfamador on his way again. Beatrice began the book after her son left her to join the Bluebirds. The manuscript so far, written in longhand, occupied 38 cubic feet inside the Taj Mahal. Every time Constant visited her, she read aloud her latest additions to the manuscript. She was reading out loud now, sitting in Rumford's old contour chair, while Constant pottered about the courtyard. She was wearing a pink and white chenille bedspread that had come with the palace. Worked into the tufts of the bedspread was the message, "God does not care." It had been Rumford's own personal bedspread. On and on Beatrice read, spinning arguments against the importance of the forces of Tralfamador. Constant did not listen attentively. He simply enjoyed Beatrice's voice, which was strong and triumphant. He was down in a manhole by the pool, turning a valve that would drain the water out. The water of the pool had been turned into something like cream of pea soup by Titanic algae. Every time Constant visited Beatrice, he fought a losing battle against the prolific green murk.
"I would be the last to deny," said Beatrice, reading her own work out loud, "that the forces of Tralfamador have had something to do with the affairs of Earth. However, those persons who have served the interests of Tralfamador have served them in such highly personalized ways that Tralfamador can be said to have had practically nothing to do with the case."
Constant, down in the manhole, put his ear to the valve he had opened. From the sound of it, the water was draining slowly. Constant swore. One of the vital pieces of information that had disappeared with Rumford and died with Salo was how they had managed, in their time, to keep the pool so crystal clean. Ever since Constant had taken over maintenance of the pool, the algae had been building up. The pool's bottoms and sides were lined with a blanket of viscid slime, and the three statues in the middle, the three sirens of Titan, were under a mucilaginous hump. Constant knew of the significance of the three sirens in his life. He had read about it, both in the Pocket History of Mars and the Winston Niles Rumford Authorized Revised Bible. The three great beauties didn't mean so much to him now, really, except to remind him that sex had once bothered him. Constant climbed out of the manhole.
"Drain slower every time," he said to Beatrice. "I don't guess I can put off digging up the pipes much longer." "That's so," said Beatrice, looking up from her writing. "That's so," said Constant. "Well, you do whatever needs to be done," said Beatrice. "That's the story of my life," said Constant. "I just had an idea that ought to go in the book," said Beatrice. "If I can just keep it from getting away." "I'll hit it with a shovel if it comes this way," said Constant. "Don't say anything for a minute," said Beatrice. "Just let me get it straight in my head."
She stood and went into the entry of the palace to escape the distractions of Constant and the rings of Saturn. She looked long at a large oil painting hanging on the entry wall. It was the only painting in the palace. Constant had had it brought all the way from Newport. It was a painting of an immaculate little girl in white, holding the reins of a white pony all her own. Beatrice knew who the little girl was. The painting was labeled with a brass plate that said, "Beatrice Rumford as a young girl." It was quite a contrast between the little girl in white and the old lady looking at her. Beatrice suddenly turned her back on the painting, walked out into the courtyard again. The idea she wanted to add to her book was straight in her mind now.
"The worst thing that could possibly happen to anybody," she said, "would be to not be used for anything by anybody."
The thought relaxed her. She lay down on Rumford's old contour chair, looked up at the appallingly beautiful rings of Saturn, at Rumford's rainbow.
"Thank you for using me," she said to Constant, "even though I didn't want to be used by anybody." "You're welcome," said Constant.
He began to sweep the courtyard. The litter he was sweeping was a mixture of sand, which had blown in from the outside, daisy seed hulls, earthling peanut hulls, empty cans of boned chicken, and discarded wads of manuscript paper. Beatrice subsisted mostly on daisy seeds, peanuts, and bone chicken, because she didn't have to cook them, because she didn't even have to interrupt her writing in order to eat them. She could eat with one hand and write with the other. And, more than anything else in life, she wanted to get everything written down. With his sweeping half done, Constant paused to see how the pool was draining. It was draining slowly. The slimy green hump that covered the three sirens of Titan was just breaking the descending surface. Constant leaned over the open manhole, listened to the water sounds. He heard the music of the pipes, and he heard something else, too. He heard the absence of a familiar and beloved sound. His mate Beatrice wasn't breathing anymore. Malachi Constant buried his mate in Titanic peat on the shore of the Winston Sea. She was buried where there were no statues. Malachi Constant said goodbye to her when the sky was filled with Titanic bluebirds. There must have been 10,000 at least of the great and noble birds. They made night of day, made the air quake with their beating wings. Not one bird cried out. And in that night, in the midst of day, Crono, the son of Beatrice and Malachi, appeared on a knoll overlooking the new grave. He wore a feather cape, which he flapped like wings. He was gorgeous and strong.
"Thank you, Mother and Father," he shouted, "for the gift of life. Goodbye."
He was gone, and the birds went with him. Old Malachi Constant went back to the palace with a heart as heavy as a cannonball. What drew him back to that sad place was a wish to leave it in good order. Sooner or later, someone else would come. The palace should be neat and clean and ready for them. The palace should speak well of the former tenant. Around Rumford's worn contour chair were the plover's eggs and wild Titanic strawberries, and the crock of fermented daisy milk, and the basket of daisy seeds that Constant had given to Beatrice. They were perishables. They would not last until the next tenant came. These Constant put back in his dugout canoe. He didn't need them. Nobody needed them. As he straightened up his old back from the canoe, he saw Salo, the little messenger from Tralfamador, walking across the water toward him.
"How do you do?" said Constant.
"How do you do?" said Salo. "Thank you for putting me back together again."
"I didn't think I did it right," said Constant. "I couldn't get a peep out of you."
"You did it right," said Salo. "I just couldn't make up my mind whether or not I wanted to peep."
He let the air out of his feet with a hiss.
"I guess I'll be moseying along," he said.
"You're going to deliver your message after all?" said Constant.
"Anybody who has traveled this far on a fool's errand," said Salo, "has no choice but to uphold the honor of the fools by completing the errand."
"My mate died today," said Constant.
"Sorry," said Salo. "I would say, is there anything I can do? But Skip once told me that that was the most hateful and stupid expression in the English language."
Constant rubbed his hands together. The only company he had left on Titan was whatever company his right hand could be for his left.
"I miss her," he said.
"You finally fell in love, I see," said Salo.
"Only an earthling year ago," said Constant. "It took us that long to realize that a purpose of human life, no matter who is controlling it, is to love whoever is around to be loved."
"If you or your son would like a ride back to Earth," said Salo, "it wouldn't be much out of my way."
My boy joined the Bluebirds, said Constant.
Good for him, said Salo. I'd join them, if they'd have me.
Earth, said Constant, wonderingly.
We could be there in a matter of hours, said Salo. Now that the ship's running right again.
It's lonely here, said Constant. Now that... He shook his head.
On the trip back to Earth, Salo suspected that he had made a tragic mistake in suggesting to Constant that he return to Earth. He had begun to suspect this when Constant insisted on being taken to Indianapolis, Indiana, USA. This insistence of Constant's was a dismaying development, since Indianapolis was far from an ideal place for a homeless old man. Salo wanted to let him off by a shuffleboard court in St. Petersburg, Florida, USA. But Constant, after the fashion of old men, could not be shaken from his first decision. He wanted to go to Indianapolis, and that was that. Salo assumed that Constant had relatives, or possibly old business connections in Indianapolis, but this turned out not to be the case.
I don't know anybody in Indianapolis, and I don't know anything about Indianapolis, except for one thing, said Constant. A thing I read in a book.
What did you read in a book? Said Salo, uneasily.
Indianapolis, Indiana, said Constant, is the first place in the United States of America where a white man was hanged for the murder of an Indian. The kind of people who'll hang a white man for murdering an Indian, said Constant. That's the kind of people for me.
Salo's head did a somersault in its gimbals. His feet made grieved sucking sounds on the iron floor. His passenger, obviously, knew almost nothing about the planet toward which he was being carried with a speed approaching that of light. At least Constant had money. There was hope in that. He had close to $3,000 in various Earthling currencies, taken from the pockets of Rumford's suits in the Taj Mahal. And at least he had clothes. He had on a terribly baggy but good tweed suit of Rumford's, complete with a Phi Beta Kappa key that hung from the watch chain that spanned the front of the vest. Salo had made Constant take the key along with the suit. Constant had a good overcoat, a hat, and overshoes too. With Earth only an hour away, Salo wondered what else he could do to make the remainder of Constant's life supportable, even in Indianapolis. And he decided to hypnotize Constant, in order that the last few seconds of Constant's life, at least, would please the old man tremendously. Constant's life would end well. Constant was already in a nearly hypnotic state, staring out at the cosmos through a porthole. Salo came up behind him and spoke to him soothingly.
You are tired, so very tired, space wanderer, Malachi,
Unk, said Salo.
Stare at the faintest star, Earthling, and think how heavy your limbs are growing.
Heavy, said Constant.
You are going to die someday, Unk, said Salo. Sorry, but it's true.
True, said Constant. Don't be sorry.
When you know you are dying, space wanderer, said Salo hypnotically, a wonderful thing will happen to you.
He then described to Constant the happy things that Constant would imagine before his life flickered out. It would be a post-hypnotic illusion.
Awake, said Salo.
Constant shuddered, turned away from the porthole.
Where am I? He said.
On a Tralfamadorian spaceship out of Titan bound for Earth, said Salo.
Oh, said Constant. Of course, he said a moment later. I must have been asleep.
Take a nap, said Salo.
Yes, I think I will, said Constant.
he lay down on a bunk. He dropped off to sleep. Salo strapped the sleeping space wanderer to his bunk. Then he strapped himself to his seat at the controls. He set three dials, double-checked the reading on each. He pressed a bright red button. He sat back. There was nothing more to do now. From now on, everything was automatic. In 36 minutes, the ship would land itself near the end of a bus line on the outskirts of Indianapolis, Indiana, USA, Earth, Solar System, Milky Way. It would be 3 in the morning there. It would also be winter. The spaceship landed in 4 inches of fresh snow in a vacant lot on the south side of Indianapolis. No one was awake to see it land. Malachi Constant got out of the spaceship.
"That's your bus stop over there, old soldier," whispered Salo.
It was necessary to whisper, for a 2-story frame house with an open bedroom window was only 30 feet away. Salo pointed to a snowy bench by the street.
"You'll have to wait about 10 minutes, he whispered. "The bus will take you right into the center of town. Ask the driver to let you off near a good hotel."
Constant nodded.
"I'll be all right," he whispered.
"How do you feel?" whispered Salo.
"Warm as toast," whispered Constant.
The complaint of a vaguely disturbed sleeper came from the open window nearby.
"Ah, somebody," the sleeper complained. "Afuadia,
You really all right?" whispered Salo.
"Yes, fine," whispered Constant. "Warm as toast."
"Good luck," whispered Salo.
"We don't say that down here," whispered Constant.
Salo winked.
"I'm not from down here," he whispered.
He looked around at the perfectly white world, felt the wet kisses of the snowflakes, pondered hidden meanings in the pale yellow streetlights that shone in a world so whitely asleep.
"Beautiful," he whispered.
"Isn't it?"
whispered Constant.
"Simfar!"
cried the sleeper menacingly to anyone who might menace his sleep.
"Sue! Aso! What's a maba?
"You better go,"
whispered Constant.
"Yes,"
whispered Salo.
"Goodbye,"
whispered Constant.
"And thanks."
"You're entirely welcome,"
whispered Salo. He backed into the ship, closed the airlock. The ship arose with the sound of a man blowing over the mouth of a bottle. It disappeared into the swirling snow and was gone.
"Toodaloo,"
it said. Malachi Constant's feet squeaked in the snow as he walked to the bench. He brushed aside the snow on the bench and sat down.
"Frah!"
cried the sleeper, as though he suddenly understood all.
"Bah!"
he cried, not liking at all what he suddenly understood.
"Sup-fo!"
he said, saying in no uncertain terms what he was going to do about it.
"Floof!"
he cried. The conspirators presumably fled. More snow fell. The bus Malachi Constant was waiting for ran 2 hours late that morning on account of the snow. When the bus did come, it was too late. Malachi Constant was dead. Salo had hypnotized him so that he would imagine, as he died, that he saw his best and only friend, Stony Stevenson. As the snow drifted over Constant, he imagined that the clouds opened up, letting through a sunbeam all for him. A golden spaceship encrusted with diamonds came skimming down the sunbeam, landed in the untouched snow of the street. Out stepped a stocky, red-headed man with a big cigar. He was young. He wore the uniform of the Martian Assault Infantry, Unk's old outfit.
"Hello, Unk," he said. "Get in."
"Get in," said Constant. "Who are you?"
"Stony Stevenson, Unk. You don't recognize me?"
"Stony?" said Constant. "That's you, Stony?"
"Who else could stand the bloody pace?"
said Stony. He laughed.
"Get in," he said.
"And go where?"
said Constant.
"Paradise,"
said Stony.
"What's paradise like?"
said Constant.
"Everybody's happy there forever,"
said Stony.
"Or as long as the bloody universe holds together."
"Get in, Unk.
Beatrice is already there, waiting for you."
"Beatrice,"
said Unk, getting into the spaceship. Stony closed the airlocks, pressed the on button.
We're going to paradise now?"
said Constant.
I'm going to get into paradise?"
"Don't ask me why, old sport," said Stony. "But somebody up there likes you."
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Supervising producer, Mike Charzik. Producer, Gail Hendricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1959 by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Audible Inc.